Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. In this episode, we have a full hour with Mohsen Hamid from his talk as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2016. Hamid is the author of three novels, including the international bestsellers The Reluctant Fundamentalist and How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. What is fascinating about Hamid is that he's a true global citizen. He was born in Pakistan, but his childhood was divided between California and Lahore. He attended Princeton and Harvard before becoming a management consultant in New York City, and it was only then that he began to seriously write, and his first novel, Moth Smoke, was published in 2000. After 9/11, Hamid left New York for London, where he lived and worked as a novelist and where his first child was born. 8 years later, he returned to Pakistan, moving into the house next door to his childhood home, where his parents still live. I'm giving you all his background info because it's important to what makes Hamid's work unique and special. He belongs to a group of contemporary writers, Chimamanda Adichie, Pico Iyer, Jeff Dyer, who are transnational and offers a perspective on the world that is elevated above common cultural or national perspectives. This seems to me to matter a lot right now. I also want to note that Hamid and his wife Zara flew all the way from Lahore just to speak for Portland Arts and Lectures, possibly setting a distance record for miles traveled for Oregon readers. He was here on the occasion of the paperback publication of Civilization and Its Discontents, a collection of his journalism from the last two decades. Here's Mohsen Hamid speaking at the Arlene Stitzer Concert Hall in 2016.
This is an amazing venue. I want to take a photograph for my mom, so if you can see why I came all the way over here. Thank you very much for coming this evening. I believe something like one in every 400 people in the Portland metropolitan area is in this room. So in proportion terms, it's one of the biggest turnouts probably in the world. So this evening, what I thought I'd do is talk to you a little bit about my life, my books, what I think about literature, politics, how we can save the world, you know, just a few of the core questions. To start things off, I was born in Lahore, Pakistan in 1971, and I was a fluent speaker of Urdu and Punjabi by the time I was 3 years old, actually 1 year old. I was known for giving speeches on the dining table. There was an election in Pakistan, and the father of Benazir Bhutto, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was becoming prime minister, and he used to say, you know, when I become prime minister, I will give you this, that, and the other. And so I, as a one-year-old or two-year-old, was fond of standing on the dining table and telling my family, you know, when I become prime minister. My mother once sort of said that I looked very cute. She came and sort of chased me off the table. I ran off the table, out the window, fell out, hit my head. It was a ground floor, and I got a scar in my head, and I bled a bit. That was what happened impersonating Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. And in a somewhat somber turn of events, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, you know, his fate was quite grim, because he was hung by the Supreme Court of Pakistan some years later. And is the first of his daughter was also assassinated in Pakistan just a few years ago. But I was, you know, unaware of these tragic events to come. And at the age of three, my dad, who was a university professor, got into the PhD program at Stanford, a little bit to the south of here, and we all went off to California for 6 years. And I arrived in California, a three-year-old Pakistani boy who spoke Urdu and Punjabi fluently, spoke no English. I don't know how many of you have been to the campus of Stanford University, but they have a place there called Escondido Village, which is the home of the graduate students who live on campus with families. And they have these identical townhouses, each one just like the next. So I was staying, we were living in one of those. On the second or third day, my mother was inside the house, and she heard crying outside, and she came outside, and she saw that I was in front of the townhouse next door to ours. I was looking up at the neighbor, thinking, you're not my mother, and he was looking down at me and thinking, what is this small Pakistani child doing at my door? And I was crying, and I was surrounded by a group of young children from all over the world. You know, Stanford campus back then felt like a little United Nations for children. And they turned to my mother and said, you know, what's wrong with him? And you know, she, like all mothers, could have said many things, but she said, you know, nothing's wrong with him. What do you mean? And they said, well, why can't he talk properly? And she said, he can speak fine. He just doesn't speak English yet. And after this incident, my parents tell me that I, who learned to speak at the age of 1 month, 1 year, and was fluently giving presidential addresses before my second birthday, didn't say a word for a month. For 1 month, I was completely silent, which, as you can imagine, I have two small children. If they didn't speak for about 5 or 10 minutes, I'd be alarmed. And if you don't speak for a month, you can imagine how frightened a parent would be. And my mother said, we should take him to a doctor. Something's gone wrong. My father said, no, no, he'll be fine. And so I spent a month in front of the TV. We had a black and white television set, which sort of coincidentally, I never realized was a black and white television set. My father explained this to me many years later. And I said, but we don't have a black and white television set. He said, no, we do. I said, but there are colors in our television set. And he said, no, there aren't. It's a black and white TV. And I was shocked, you know, because I saw all these colors in our black and white TV. Anyway, so that's sort of a young novelist in the making. But I didn't speak for a month, and I watched a lot of TV. And a month later, when I next spoke, my parents were a bit surprised because I spoke in full sentences in perfect English with a, you know, Californian accent. And and 6 years would pass, and I spent the next 6 years as a young Californian boy in the 1970s wearing, you know, moccasins and the hip garb of the 1970s, and my friends were from all over the world, you know, the children of an African-American poet, an Israeli aircraft engineer, you know, Canadian physicist. And I learned how to read and write in the United States. I learned how to, I made my first friends that I remember in the United States. I watched Star Wars, and at a very young age, composed my first book, which was a intergalactic space opera with stick figure illustrations, and fortunately it hasn't been published, and but my mother has a copy of it, and it actually exists. And you know, it was my earliest literary, if anybody wants to ask, you know, my earliest literary influence was probably Star Wars. And at the age of 9, I moved back to Pakistan. And it was only when we moved back to Pakistan, my parents and I and my baby sister, who was born in California and was about a year old when we moved back, that my parents discovered, much to their dismay and perhaps horror, I didn't speak a word of Urdu. You know, somewhere in my 6 or 7 year Californian sojourn, I had lost my first language, and English had become my only language. So, oddly enough, I was a child who had a second language, English, but no first language, and I still don't really have a first language. I then relearned Urdu when I went back to Pakistan. But English now is my best language. I couldn't write a novel in Urdu, even though I did study it in school and, you know, was, I suppose, okay at it. But I learned to speak Urdu again. I learned to settle into Pakistani society. But I guess I felt a kind of strange tension as a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy, that I looked like everybody around me, all of my fellow Pakistanis. But yet, I was a little bit of a fraud, because deep down inside, I was something else as well. And that feeling of being of two places really began for me then. I'd forgotten the incident where I didn't speak for a month and was clearly a little traumatized by those kids in California. But in my memory, I certainly remember moving back to Pakistan at the age of 9. And Pakistan was, you know, a weird place, a wonderful place also, and a weird place. In America, I had no relatives except for my parents. And I called my parents by their first names, you know, Naseem and Naved, to the complete shock and horror of everybody I knew in Pakistan. I quickly stopped doing this, and they became, you know, mother and father. But I had no cousins in America. I had over 24, 25 cousins in Pakistan. I had no aunts or uncles in America. You know, in Pakistan, my father was one of four, my mother was one of nine. We didn't have grandparents in America. In Pakistan, I lived with my father's parents, and every weekend we spent with my mother's parents. So it was a pretty dramatic change. And on top of that, you know, back then in Pakistan, there were no pizzas, there was no McDonald's, you know, you couldn't get refills for your trapper keeper. There was, it was really a shocking change. And I found that I was, I guess without really being fully aware of it, desperate for connections back to this American childhood of mine. And one of the biggest differences was in Pakistan, it's sort of hard to imagine for those of you who are, you know, in your 20s or 30s now, or even younger. But we had only one television station in Pakistan. And this station was only on for a few hours a day. And most of what it showed for those few hours a day were religious programming, you know, and or news programs. But once a week, for 1 hour, I think it was Wednesday nights, there was an American TV show. You know, Knight Rider or Battlestar Galactica or Trapper John MD, you know. I don't know who decided which shows to, kind of eclectic set of shows, but they would have one show. And I would watch this show with such excitement and desire and, you know, I didn't know why I was so excited, but it I suppose connected me to a kind of past. Anyway, I read a lot and I fantasized about all sorts of stuff. Like many teenagers, I had a very active daydreaming life, you know, that I would score the winning goal in the football, soccer competition of my high school, or the pretty girl in the first row would suddenly turn around to me and confess that she'd loved me all these months, or, you know, some violent attackers would approach my friends and I would disarm them, and, you know, the kind of things that teenage boys, or at least that this teenage boy, fantasized about. And I was a dreamy kid, and I read a lot, and I imagined a lot. I didn't really write fiction, but I did have a sort of strange fiction creation-like experience, another, I guess you could say, early antecedent, along with Star Wars, into my literary production. I left California just after discovering a game called Dungeons and Dragons. I don't know how many of you are familiar. Some of you are laughing, so I think that some of you are familiar with this. But Dungeons and Dragons was like a, you know, a massive online role-playing game that wasn't online and wasn't necessarily very massive. But you were imagined being characters, and you were a wizard or a, you know, half-orc or a paladin. Now, Dungeons and Dragons is meant to be played with a group of characters, players, friends. And one person, the dungeon master, creates the universe in which the other characters are wandering around, and, you know, tells them and describes it. So I became the dungeon master of a Dungeons and Dragons game where nobody else was playing. So I would, it's almost pathetic now to think back, but would imagine, you know, create these dungeons and map them out in intricate detail on chart paper, you know, those little grid square papers, and have these, you know, intricate stories. And I had no idea at the time, but I was really, in a sense, creating my first novels. You know, I was imagining characters, players, you know, call them readers, entering into this domain that I had created within certain rules, the rules of the Dungeons and Dragons universe, but those rules were, you know, quite broad. And I really enjoyed doing this. for quite some time. Eventually, I made friends, I suppose, and it came to an end. But I was really into this kind of thing. I did something else, which in retrospect was equally bizarre. I'll tell you about that as well. If there's any high school student out there who does weird stuff like this, you know, we'll talk afterwards. There's two of us in the world. I used to love atlases. I found atlases with their maps of the world unbelievably interesting. And now, of course, you just Google or Google Map, in fact, the world. Back then, there were these books. And in those books were maps, and in those maps were all kinds of things, you know, where the cities were, how many people lived in those cities. They had contour lines that curved around them that showed you how high an elevation was, and whether it was forested or desert, whether it was sea, and I just found these things incredible. And I used to imagine, with these atlases, the existence of countries that didn't actually exist, you know, that Lahore was part of a union of city-states, which also happened to include the San Francisco Bay Area. And it's not very difficult to interpret, you know, the meaning of these fantasies. But I guess I'm telling you these things because, to me, when I look back at them, they do help explain, you know, my trajectory towards becoming a novelist. And part of that trajectory was, of course, wanting the world to be a little different, you know, wanting perhaps Lahore and San Francisco to be a lot closer to each other and maybe being able to walk over one weekend from one to the other. And part of it was a way of dealing with solitude and passing time by oneself. And part of it was trying to reconcile an experience as a child, which already at this point had involved two big ruptures, one at the age of 3 and one at the age of 9, where I'd left a world and gone to another world. And in the new world, I never spoke to somebody from the old world. So after I moved to Pakistan in 1980 at the age of 9, I never spoke to any of my childhood friends again. There was no email. There was no FaceTime. And phone calls were unbelievably expensive. So that was it. And clearly in me that triggered some sort of fictional response, but I had no idea at this point I wanted to be a novelist. I got into university at Princeton, and I went off to Princeton, and there I discovered that there were these courses in creative writing. And it seemed to me that this must be a scam, like really you could write stories for a class, and they were also pass-fail. You know, the temptation was obvious. I can make stuff up, and it's pass, fail, and it counts as much as like a physics class. Or, I signed up, and I began writing my first, adultish fiction in these classes, and I had the good fortune of taking two semesters with Joyce Carol Oates, who was a fantastic teacher, is a fantastic teacher. I think she's just retired from Princeton and perhaps moved out to Berkeley. But she was really quite incredible. And in my senior year, I got into a long fiction workshop with Toni Morrison, and I began writing my first novel. And I'm probably one of the few writers in the world of my generation who can honestly say that Toni Morrison read him before he read her. And I was very embarrassed by this because once we were out for lunch and I realized that I'm studying with this amazing, fantastic professor. I'm in awe of her. I've never read any of her books, and I better read something. So I got Jazz. And Jazz was sitting underneath my pile of books at lunch, and after lunch she sort of looked over and said, "What do you got there?" And I showed her my copy of Jazz, and she took it and she signed it for me. And then she said to me, "Read Beloved. It's good." And And she was right. I mean, it was, I thought jazz was pretty amazing. Beloved was unbelievable. And you know, I learned a great deal from these teachers. But perhaps the most important thing I learned from them was that I could be a writer. Until this point in my life, it never occurred to me that I could be a writer. I thought, you know, that something like that didn't really exist. It wasn't an actual job. Nobody did this for a living, or even much for fun. But when you have Joyce Carol Oates and Toni Morrison reading your stuff and giving you, you know, somewhat positive feedback from time to time, you begin to think, you know, maybe I can do this. And that's a huge gift. It's you know, I, young people sometimes ask me, should I do an MFA in creative writing or should I study creative writing? And I don't know how to answer that question because I didn't do an MFA. I went and studied other things. But certainly the idea of these heroic writers, these two titanic women of letters, taking seriously what I had to do, was something that made possible my future writing, and in that sense, I think hugely valuable if you can expose yourself to it, but not the only way to teach yourself as a writer. Anyway, I was writing my first novel. It became it's called Moth Smoke. I finished a draft in 1993 when I graduated from Princeton. I still have that first draft with Toni Morrison's comments written on the back, and she has this beautiful fountain pen, you know, handwriting, and exquisite. She also reads beautifully. I mean, one of the nice things about Toni Morrison is that if she reads to you the back of, like, a, you know, Cheerios box, you think, oh my God, you know, wow, high fructose, you know, corn syrup. You're thinking, who came up with that idea of high fructose corn, the rhythm of it, the cadence? And she had that effect of, you know, she would read my stuff, everybody else's stuff, and it just sounded so beautiful. And I think one thing which she taught me and which I learned from that was how important it was to read my stuff out loud. And even today, a typical writing day for me is maybe about a third typing stuff into a keyboard and about two-thirds pacing around my study like a madman, reading my stuff out loud over and over and over and over again, and try to make it work in my head and smooth it out a little bit. So I finished university, and I had this draft of my novel, and I went off to work on it some more. I was in Pakistan for a year writing what would become Moth Smoke, and then I got into law school at Harvard. At this point, I still didn't think it was possible to make a living writing books. I'm not entirely certain it is even now, but it seemed impossible, inconceivable when I was younger, and so I figured I better get some kind of a job. Law school seemed a good, you know, approach. I wrote a draft of the novel for Toni Morrison, a draft after college in the year off, and then kept working on it at law school. I discovered very early on in law school that I didn't like the law, and that was a slight, you know, downer. And I had $100,000 of law school debt, and I had gone to this illustrious law school, Harvard, and I just knew I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I couldn't run away because, being a Pakistani citizen, I couldn't take out student loans on my own. So my father's dear friend from Stanford, a man named Blake Downing, used to jog with my dad in the hills. And interestingly enough, he had volunteered to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces during the Vietnam War. And yet, the same man wound up underwriting and co-sponsoring $100,000 of debt for a young Pakistani kid that he barely knew, simply because of his friendship with my dad. I tell my Pakistani friends this story from time to time, just to say that, you know, you never know people's, what they do in their lives, what their political views are, and their decency as human beings aren't always what you expect of them. And, you know, I think of this now. If some young kid came to me and said, hey, would you mind, like, signing the promissory notes of my $100,000 of law school debt, I would be, you know, pretty nervous. But he never blinked. And I'm, you know, I think I'll always be very grateful to him for that. I went to law school. I had this debt. And I discovered that law wasn't really my thing. And so there was a professor at Harvard who taught a course called Law and Literature, Richard Parker. And I took the course, and then I went to Professor Parker and said, hey, Professor Parker, look, I don't really want to write a law thesis, which I have to do to get my degree. I'd kind of rather submit a work of fiction. And he looked at me, you know, with tired eyes from across his desk at Harvard Law School and said, you know what, Mohsen, I didn't really want to read another law school thesis, to be honest with you. And if you can find some way of arguing that this fiction has something to do with the law, even tangentially, you've got a deal. And so Mothsmoke, my first novel, which was now in its fifth draft or whatever, I had the idea that I'm going to rewrite this book as a trial, where you, the audience, are cast as a judge, and all the other characters will tell you their stories, and you, in a kind of surreal judgment, will have to decide the fate of these characters. And I told Professor Parker that the novel is about replicating through fiction what the litigation process seeks to do. In other words, the novel is about arriving at truth through competing, contradictory narratives. And he said, great, let's do it. And so on that, you know, somewhat flimsy but actually true basis, I wound up writing a novel about a trial at Harvard Law School. And I've been told since that many people have done this and that it's become an open thing, and they don't even have to pretend that their books are to do with the law anymore. So it's like an escape valve for, you know, those who wound up in law school by mistake. And so I, you know, graduated from law school, but I didn't want to go back to Pakistan yet. I had all these loans to pay off. I didn't want to work in a law firm. And so I got a job working in management consulting with McKinsey & Company in New York City. And for those of you who aren't familiar with McKinsey & Company, it's a very intense management consulting firm. Advises, you know, executives on the strategies of their businesses. And I kind of had a blast there for several years. And at the first year retreat for the first year associates, the head of the New York office of McKinsey was this very cool guy called Pete Walker. And I was sitting next to Pete Walker at the end of a long, long evening of revelry. And he was looking vulnerable and, you know, barely keeping his head up. And so I pounced and said, you know, Pete, I'm working on this novel and would love to find a way to, you know, make it work with my McKinsey career. And he says, what do you need? And I said, look, I'm thinking I take 3 months off unpaid each year, and I have my vacation time, and I write the novel in that time, and I work. And he said, fine, sure, go for it. Anyway, he probably didn't remember this conversation the next day, but I immediately went to HR, informed the head of the New York office, and made a decision. And so I was able to have time while working at McKinsey to work on this novel. And while it wasn't what I wanted to do with my life, it taught me an enormous amount. But Mothsmoke was finally done, and it was published in the year 2000, around my 28th birthday. Between my 28th and 29th birthday, I was 28 years old. And Mothsmoke was a novel that, in a sense, tried to talk about a Pakistan which I had experienced quite intimately, but hadn't seen represented in fiction, really, which is the Pakistan of young urban kids, you know, falling in love, having sex, doing drugs, or trying to have sex and trying to find drugs. And you know, that urban reality, I mean, Pakistan's a country with more than a million heroin addicts, and yet the drug subculture of Pakistan seemed to me at that point to be minimally explored in fiction. And similarly, writing from India didn't talk about this kind of stuff very much, and the rise of this new business class and the huge emphasis on money and the decline of law and order and all these changes. And so I wanted to write a novel about Pakistan that was intimately familiar with Pakistan, but yet came from somebody who had a, at least partially, American view of the world. And so Malt Smoke was written, and it was published in the year 2000. And I'll just read to you the first two or three paragraphs so that you get a sense of what it sounds like and what it feels like as a novel. This is the main character. His name is Darashiko Shazad. And in the course of this novel, you, the reader, are his judge. He's on trial for something. But basically, he falls in love with his best friend's wife and becomes a heroin addict. So as you can imagine, things don't turn out, you know, swimmingly for him. But here's how it goes. Steadying the steering wheel with my knees, I pull the last unbroken cigarette out of a battered pack of flakes. There are trees by the side of the road, but only on one side, and it's the wrong side. So their shadows run away from me in long smiles that jump over boundary walls and grin at each other while I bake in my car like a snail on hot asphalt. Knees turn the wheel left, then right, steering around an ambitious pothole, a crack aspiring to canyonhood. Fingers twist the barrel of the cigarette, loosening the tobacco, coaxing it into a sweaty palm, rubbing the flake between thumb and forefinger until it's almost empty. Eyes flick up and down, watching the road through the arc the steering wheel cuts above the dashboard, foot gentle on the accelerator. Slide the ashtray out and tip half the tobacco in. Take the compass I've had longer than I've had this car, which is a long time, and spear the hash on one blackened end. Left hand holds the tobacco in its palm and the compass in its fingers. Right hand grips a plastic lighter while its thumb spins the flint. Sparks, no flame. Sparks, no flame. Then a light. And when the blue fire licks the hash, a sweet smell with a suddenness that's almost eager. Crumble the hash into the tobacco. Crush it, break it. Feel the heat telling nerves and fingertips to pass on the message of a little hurt. Knead it, mix it thoroughly. Hold empty flake in mouth by its filter. Suck and refill. Pack against a thumbnail. Tip, tip, tip. Repeat. Tip, tip, tip. And twist the end shut. Incisors grab a bit of filter. Pull it out gently, like a bitch lifting a pup. Tear off a strip to let the smoke through. Reinsert the rest to hold open the end and keep things in their place. I light up while rubbing the hash and tobacco residue off my hand and onto my jeans, rolling while rolling, solo, and baking while baking in the heat. It helps kill time on long afternoons, and I haven't traveled very far, but I know that no place has afternoons longer than this place, Lahore, especially in the summertime. Two drops of Visine, and I'm set. That's how it sort of begins. And, you know, in a way, Malt Smoke, thank you. When Malt Smoke was published, there were two, I guess, very interesting reactions that I had in Pakistan. One was my grand uncle, who I had mentioned was on the Supreme Court of Pakistan. He was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Pakistan. And he called me over to see him, and he said, Mohsen, I've read this book. And I said, yes, grand uncle. And he said, you've gone on your mother's side, haven't you? And you know, but nobody really knew. My mother was very nervous about the response, how people were going to react to a book like this in Pakistan. It turns out that lots and lots of young people in Pakistan and India really got into Malt Smoke. It was a very strange thing. I didn't know what to expect, but next thing I knew, you know, young kids are passing it to their cousins, and it's spreading among sort of this urban class of people in Pakistan. And in fact, so much so, I was at a literary festival in India 15 years after this book came out, 10, 15 years, and this stranger taps me on the shoulder at some music concert, and I turn around, and he says, are you Mohsen Ahmed, the guy who wrote Malt Smoke? I said, you know, yes. He says, dude, I want to have a joint with you. So, you know, every writer has its own little moments like this. And that's how I knew that Malt Smoke had an impact on both sides of the border. But the book was published in the year 2000, and I began to work on my second novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist. And in the summer of 2001, around my 30th birthday, I handed my agent a copy of a manuscript of The Reluctant Fundamentalist. And it was a story of a Pakistani guy, a Muslim guy, working in corporate New York City, who is doing a corporate job and starts wondering whether he believes in what he's doing. And he has a love affair, a sort of failed love affair, and he grows a beard and decides to move back to Pakistan. It was a quiet little fable of a novel, and I gave it to my agent in the summer of 2001, and my agent read it and said, you know, Mohsen, I don't really buy this, you know, this guy, Muslim guy, feels this tension with America and sort of, you know, grows a beard and goes back to Pakistan. Like, you know, why does he do that? Anyway, and then, of course, a month or two later, less than 2 months later, the terrorist atrocities of September 11th took place, and perhaps a month or two after that, my agent called me and said, hey, Mohsen, you know that novel about the Muslim guy, you know, with the tension with America? How's that coming along, the rewrite? And in a way, you know, September 11th obviously ended thousands of lives and changed many more lives and launched wars that scarred thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. But it also had the effect of completely overwhelming this little fable I was writing. Because I thought, you know, what do I do with this now? I mean, you're going to read this book and say, the guy moves back to Pakistan, and then September 11th happens. It felt like it was a prequel, an explanation of this horrific event, and it wasn't meant to be that. So I spent years rewriting this book, and I tried everything. I tried it in the first person with an American accent, in the third person, a Pakistani accent, this, that, the other. I was going nowhere. And the years were going by. I kept setting it before September 11th. I didn't want to deal with September 11th in fiction. It just felt too raw and too recent. So I was grappling with this. And the great writer Douglas Adams, I know how many of you are familiar with his work. Some of you are familiar. He's the author of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series of novels. And at one point he writes that the secret to flying is throwing yourself at the ground and missing. And that is really how I approach writing novels. I throw myself at the ground and hit, you know, repeatedly for years. I write draft after draft after draft after draft. Same was true with Maltsmoke. My first novel took 7 years. And eventually, hopefully, I miss. And with The Reluctant Fundamentalist, the way that I wound up missing was I showed a draft to my editor, and my editor got back and said, look, you know how much I love your first book and how much I wanted to love this book. It just doesn't work. You've written in this, like, American accent, which maybe to you seems like a, you know, skill, you know, sort of technically virtuoso performance. And to me, it reads like every other thing I've ever read in my life. And it's also kind of boring. So I thought, you know, I gotta fix the voice. How is this character going to speak? And I thought, you know, I want this novel in a way to not give people answers about fundamentalism, terrorism, these sorts of things, but to reveal a little bit to themselves how their own biases and stereotypes and view of the world color the way they look at things. I want to write a novel that's a bit of a mirror to readers in these frightened years, so that we can be aware of our own fears and how those subtly color the way we look at people who are different from ourselves. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to write this book about this character where there's nothing about him that's particularly religious, but yet he is plausibly a quote-unquote religious fundamentalist. And how am I going to do that? Well, he grows a beard, but what else? And the what else was his voice. I said, you know, I'm going to try to make him sound Muslim. Now, that's a kind of absurd thing to do because there's, you know, 1.2 or 1.5 billion Muslims, and, you know, they sound as different from each other as people in Oregon or California or Texas or, you know, the billion or two Christians of the world. Two Muslims don't sound any more like each other than, you know, Pamela Anderson and the Pope sound like each other. But But maybe there's an idea of what Muslimness is to some people who, you know, live in countries which don't have very many Muslims in them. And I thought, you know, it might be that that Islam or Muslims strike people as being, you know, kind of rigid, having a sort of rule-based view of the world, hailing from the past, a bit anachronistic, something old, and vaguely menacing. And so I tried to create a voice that had some of those elements. And in particular, the voice that I found for that was there's a kind of accent that's taught in some of Pakistan's elite private schools that were set up by the British in the late 19th century, where some young kids emerge with a kind of weird, almost, you know, British accent from 150 years ago. And that's meant to connote a certain type of social class. And the main character of this novel is from a family that he considers to be an upper-class good family, but also a broke family. And so that accent is very important to him because it's how he conveys to the world that he comes from, you know, good breeding and good, a good family, even though he has no money. In fact, because he has no money, it's important. And then it became, okay, I have this voice, and I'm going to write this novel where the main character meets some stranger, this American character, plausibly American character, and starts talking to him, and we never hear what the American says. So it's like a one-man play. It's a form that's called the dramatic monologue and was used by many others, and in my case, most usefully, Albert Camus, who used it in The Fall, his novel. And I thought, you know, this is the way I'm going to do this book. It'll be a half conversation where you only hear the Pakistani character. And I described it, you know, to my editor as a thriller in which nothing thrilling happens. And, you know, she said, don't say that to anybody else. But I think it's true. And many people have described this book as a thriller. It was made into a Hollywood film, into a film by Meera Nair with a number of Hollywood actors. And they had a difficult time making the film because in the book, it's, you know, it's a bit like, for those of you who have seen it, Gunfight at the OK Corral. Now, in Gunfight at the OK Corral, there is no gunfight for like 99% of the film. And there's just the build-up to the gunfight at the OK Corral. And that 99% is sort of like what this novel is, except I won't tell you the end, but let's just say that I stand by my original assessment. I'll read to you a little bit of it, and we're running out of time. You know, time flies when you're going on at length about yourself. I'll read you a little bit about this, and I'll tell just a couple of words about my last one, and hopefully talk more about politics and Pakistan, what's happening in the world, and all that in your questions and answers. But this is how the beginning of Dutton Fundamentalist is. Excuse me, sir, but may I be of assistance? Ah, I see I have alarmed you. Do not be frightened by my beard. I am a lover of America. I noticed that you were looking for something. More than looking, in fact, you seem to be on a mission. And since I am both a native of this city and a speaker of your language, I thought I might offer you my services. How did I know you were American? No, not by the color of your skin. We have a range of complexions in this country, and yours occurs often among the people of our northwest frontier. Nor was it your dress that gave you away. A European tourist could as easily have purchased in Des Moines your suit with its single vent and your button-down shirt. True, your hair, short-cropped, and your expansive chest, the chest, I would say, of a man who bench-presses regularly and maxes out well above 225, are typical of a certain type of American. But then again, sportsmen and soldiers of all nationalities tend to look alike. Instead, it was your bearing that allowed me to identify you. And I do not mean that as an insult, for I see your face is hardened, but merely as an observation. Come, tell me, what were you looking for? Surely at this time of day, only one thing could have brought you to the district of Old Anarkali named, as you must be aware, after a courtesan immured for loving a prince. And that is the quest for the perfect cup of tea. Have I guessed correctly? Then allow me, sir, to suggest my favorite among these many establishments. Yes, this is the one. Its metal chairs are no better upholstered, its wooden tables are equally rough, and it is, like the others, open to the sky. But the quality of its tea, I assure you, is unparalleled. And that's how it begins between these two characters. This Pakistani meets this, thank you. This Pakistani meets this, you know, probably American, although the American never speaks, could be a befuddled Canadian tourist saying, why do you keep calling me an American? But are you sure I'll have some tea? You know, and really, in a way, it's a novel about the fact that we're all operating with insufficient information. You know, we're all operating in an uncertain world. We just don't know. Is this bearded guy next to me on the plane a terrorist? Is this American dude in my home city of Lahore a CIA killer? Probably not in both cases, but, you know, we just don't know. We never know. And many people would like to give us certainty and tell us to assume one thing or the other. But the fact of it is we each have to, in our own way, find some way of navigating this uncertainty and navigating, in many times, the sense of dread that we feel and the sense of fear that we feel. And how do we hold on to our own decency and our own sense of judgment and our own faith in another human being's humanity in a world that seems to be constantly telling us to ignore those things? And that's what The Rotten Fundamentalist is about. In the interest of time, I won't say much more about it, but that book came out and it became a film also. It was adapted for the cinema and it wound up sort of going into many translations, and it made it possible for me to consider writing full-time and not doing a job. And so I stopped working and got to work on my next novel, which was, you know, very optimistically titled How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia was a novel about having moved back to Pakistan. I went to London in the year 2001 and was there for about 8 years. I met my wife. We had our first child, a baby girl, and we decided to move back to Pakistan in 2009. And in Pakistan, I started working on this novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, which pretends to be a self-help book that tells you how to get filthy rich in Rising Asia, and actually does do that to a certain extent, but is also a look at inequality and how societies are, you know, structured from the very, very poor sliver of the rural poor in a place like Pakistan to the richest industrialist. And also a human life from birth until death. One thing for me when I moved back to Pakistan was I was now living as the middle generation of three generations. Our daughter, and now we have two children. My wife and myself were in the middle, our kids were the youngest, and then our parents were the older generation. And so for the first time, I was in the middle of this arc and not the youngest. And I think seeing one's parents get older and living close by and made me think a lot about the arc of a life and how we each pass, you know, through these phases, those of us whose lives are not interrupted through these phases. And I thought, you know, how, you know, sad and upsetting and disconcerting it was to see people that you love getting old and knowing it would happen to you and to everybody else that you know. And I thought that, you know, there's this fear that I have of mortality that I imagine many of us have of mortality. And I wanted to write a novel that was about that and that tried to enter into a space where normally many of the powerful ways we've dealt with mortality and this flow of a human life have become weaker and weaker. So, you know, once upon a time we had communities and large groups of people, extended families, all living in the same place. But now so many people move from place to place or from the countryside to the city that those things are breaking down. And we had, you know, folk tales and culture and old ways of talking about things, and those are also similarly breaking down. And we had powerful family systems, and the families are getting, you know, weaker. And of course, we had religion, but religion all over the world is being increasingly politicized. And as it becomes politicized, very often religion can turn, in many cases, its concern away from what unites us all, which is this experience of being, you know, mortal as human beings, into a different conversation about, you know, why my group is different from your group. And in Pakistan, I saw so much of this, and I thought, you know, I want to write a text that deals with this religious or spiritual question, or rather a question which is normally handled in a religious or spiritual domain. And I want to write about it in a way that is not of any particular religious tradition. It's not anti-religion, but it's also not predicated upon a particular religious belief. And I thought it was important for me to do this because all around me, I was seeing all these people increasingly angry with each other because of some narrow definition of the religious group they belong to. And so How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, in a way, was drawing on a tradition that existed in Pakistan, that part of the world, for many centuries, which is the Sufi love poem. And I'll say a little bit about that. So among the strands of Islam and Islamic tradition is one strand that's called Sufism. And within Sufism, one of the main ways of expressing spirituality is through poetry, historically has been through poetry and song. And above all, in the notion that love provides some degree of a release from the horror and terror that we feel at being mortal, and a sense of union with something bigger than ourselves. And I never really, I understood this concept, I guess, intellectually. I never really got it until I moved back to Pakistan, when I saw my dad, you know, playing with my daughter every morning and making these plans, you know, building this bicycle track and this jungle gym and all of these things, and getting so excited about, you know, her, what she'd be doing in 5 years and 10 years. And meanwhile, my father's brother passed away and his best friend passed away, and yet my father was so excited about this future. And I realized that in some way, his love for this child had altered his relationship to time, that he was able to be so excited and optimistic about a future which was really her future. And not because he even necessarily thought he would be there for all of it, but just because he was excited for her on her behalf. And that, I think, was very powerful for me to see, because it was this notion that, you know, so often we use the word love and we use it in a very self-centered way, you know. I love your shoes, you know, or I love you in a romantic sense, which means I want to possess you. I want you to be mine. I want you to make me less lonely. But there is an older and more powerful version of that word, which is that I want to make you less lonely. That it isn't about me necessarily. It's about something that is allows me to transcend me. So How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia is a novel that explores this crushing burden of economic competition and inequality and globalization, which occurs just as much here in the Pacific Northwest as it does in Pakistan, and how that leaves a kind of hollowness. And it's about a love story, these two characters who are loved their whole lives. And that love story may or may not offer some way out. I won't tell you, but if you read the book, you'll find out for yourself. Anyway, I'll read to you a little bit from the very beginning, and I think we are out of time, so I'll stop and then we'll do some questions. But this is how to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia begins. Look, unless you're writing one, a self-help book is an oxymoron. You read a self-help book so someone who isn't yourself can help you, that someone being the author. This is true of the whole self-help genre. It's true of how-to books, for example, and it's true of personal improvement books, too. Some might even say it's true of religion books, but some others might say that those who say that should be pinned to the ground and bled dry with a slow slice of a blade across their throats. So it's wisest simply to note a divergence of views on that subcategory and move swiftly on. None of the foregoing means self-help books are useless. On the contrary, they can be useful indeed. But it does mean that the idea of self in the land of self-help is a slippery one. And slippery can be good. Slippery can be pleasurable. Slippery can provide access to what would chafe if entered dry. This book is a self-help book. Its objective, as it says on the cover, is to show you how to get filthy rich in rising Asia. And to do that, it has to find you, huddled, shivering, on the packed earth under your mother's cot one cold, dewy morning. Your anguish is the anguish of a boy whose chocolate has been thrown away, whose remote controls are out of batteries, whose scooter is busted, whose new sneakers have been stolen. This is all the more remarkable since you've never in your life seen any of these things. The whites of your eyes are yellow, a consequence of spiking bilirubin levels in your blood. The virus afflicting you is called hepatitis E. Its typical mode of transmission is fecal-oral. Yum. It kills only about 1 in 50, so you're likely to recover, but right now you feel like you're going to die. Your mother has encountered this condition many times, or conditions like it anyway, so maybe she doesn't think you're going to die. Then again, maybe she does. Maybe she fears it. Everyone is going to die. And when a mother like yours sees in a third-born child like you the pain that makes you whimper under her cot the way you do, maybe she feels your death push forward a few decades, take off its dark, dusty headscarf, and settle with open-haired familiarity and a lascivious smile into this, the single mud-walled room she shares with all of her surviving offspring. What she says is, don't leave us here. And in this novel, basically, the way it works is that you, the reader, are you, this character, a poor boy growing up in some unnamed country, an unnamed boy growing up in an unnamed country, in the ultimate of destitute human poverty, no clean water, no electricity, no modern healthcare. And you, in the course of the novel, grow up. And you move to the city, and you find your way to a certain degree of fortune. And along this journey, you are seeing this great migration, the greatest migration of our time, which is the migration of people from the countryside to the cities all over Asia and Africa. And the novel follows you from your birth until your death, really. But in addition to you being this character, you're also the reader. And the novel is a kind of dance between the reader and the writer, where it begins, you know, in a slightly more cynical tone. But by the end, it trashes to something which is, you know, very sincere and earnest. And the reason for doing that, it's the last thing I'll say, the reason for doing that is it's a bit like, you know, going to a bar. And somebody sits down next to you and says, you know, I'd like to speak to you very earnestly about some sincere stuff. And, you know, you look at that person and sort of turn away and, you know, as soon as you can, move out of the bar. Because there's no relationship. But in a novel, over the course of the hours you read a novel, a relationship is formed. And so what the novel tries to do is to initially be the unthreatening, somewhat cynical, chatty companion that we need to get comfortable with, but then in the end tries to go to a very different place. And I won't say more about it than that. I hope some of you have time to read it one day. Thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
That was Mohsen Hammad speaking at the Arlene Schitzer Concert Hall in 2016. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from The Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.